Sam Bankman-Fried was a crypto wonderkind. His exchange FTX soared in value. He championed crypto regulation and promised a philanthropy focus. But then the market crashed. Questions arose about FTX's solvency. The company collapsed, wiping out billions and leaving investors scrambling. SBF, once hailed as a visionary, faced accusations and investigations. He's been thrown 25 years behind bars. Millions of customers joined the exchange. America and the United States, there's barely anyone who pays attention to media that didn't know about FTX. So it's a comprehensively absorbed brand. And Bankman-Fried crossed the globe on private jets. And he was at dinner with people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. And like he was hobnobbing with the best of people, or at least the highest echelons in society.
Hi there, and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. I'm Mike, and joining me in today's episode is My Wall Street's chief investor, Emmett Savage. If you want to get more from My Wall Street and level up your investing game, head on over to mywallstreet.com. We're giving away a full deep dive on one of our favorite deep moat stocks. All you have to do is sign up for the mailing list. For more information, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. Today's podcast is brought to you by Vodafone Business. Now, if you're like us here in My Wall Street, you know that running a business is difficult. There are countless things to think about, and many often simply get ignored or completely forgot about. Well, that's where Vodafone Business can help. They've crafted a suite of tools and supports to boost your business's operations, and the best part is it's free for everyone. From cybersecurity to harnessing the power of AI, building a website, and improving how your teams work remotely, Vodafone Business will help you address the often overlooked but crucial elements for your business's success. To get started today, check out their one-to-one VHub digital support and advice service. You'll find everything you need right there. Find the link in our show notes or simply Google Vodafone VHub for more details. Now, let's get into the episode. Emmett, how are you doing?
How are you, Mike?
I'm good. Now, I'm sitting beside my window here and there's a bunch of construction outside, and I'm really hoping they take a very French approach to once it's 5 p.m., tools down. But if there's any kind of banging in the background, excuse me, all right?
You'll be straight into the jacks again. Do you know what my wife had the audacity to say to me before this podcast? Good luck. She doesn't recognize me as a performing artiste. You don't say good luck to an actor or actress. You say break a leg. And she's like, I said, thank you very much. I'm glad I've achieved this highest level of attainment in broadcasting, and you've just told me good luck.
Okay, before we go into the show, I just was reading Matt Levine this morning and I thought this was very interesting. So we obviously talked at length about the Trump SPAC last week, but apparently, so obviously we were talking about it was at the time anyways, it was 10 billion market cap, bringing in about 4 million a year and losing about 60 million. But obviously anyone with their right mind would look at shorting that if that was the game you're in. So apparently it's really the most expensive stock ever to short. So the contract to borrow the stock to short it, it'll cost someone about 500% a year. So, and I think a lot of that has to do with Trump owning so much of it, maybe. So it's the most expensive U.S. company to bet against, with over $100 million of short interest. And that's by a large margin as well. So say of that $100 million, if it doesn't keep going down and those contracts have to extend, it'll cost them 500% on their capital just to keep betting against it.
That's very interesting, because recently, in the last 6 months, my main stock brokerage account moved from TD Ameritrade over to Schwab. And as you know, I don't really participate in options, or only on the rarest of occasions. But last week after our podcast, I hopped into Schwab to have a look at the option chain on DJT, just to see what the short interest was like. And I thought it was a user error. I thought, no, these contracts are too expensive. I did not know that, and that explains it. I wasn't even interested enough to go digging and figure out why on earth the put option was so expensive. And that explains it there.
That's also, and I know it fell about 20% there after reported earnings, whatever earnings it had. But it's also another factor behind why it could probably extend its run as this meme stock for longer than people anticipate. But it's sure to be a story this whole year during the election, I imagine anyways. I'm not sure. Matt Levine's piece this morning was really good on it.
I must jump into it. I was reading in Business Insider during the week an article called How to Spot the Next Meme Stock.
That'd be a very, very lucrative skill.
Wouldn't it? I mean, like, it's very trivial. Like the piece, I mean, you could have written it on the back of the bus on the way to school, where most good Irish school children do their homework. But it was kind of like an absence of earnings and all things to do. Numerics are in the common media and it's known to everyone and blah, 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 blah. But it was an interesting one. But they used, of course, Trump as a case study on the very piece, which I didn't think was fair at all. Give the man some space.
Okay, so we are talking controversial figures, and we're going to kick it off with Sam Bankman-Fried. So he was sentenced to 25 years last year for his role in the collapse and widespread fraud surrounding FTX, the crypto trading platform. Interestingly, the article I was reading did a kind of comparison of grand-scale frauds in recent times. So Bankman-Fried got 25 years, which is more than double Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos's, but only a sixth of Bernie Madoff, who got 150 years. That's the scale, I suppose.
Yeah, we can do Top of the Pops. I actually must have been reading the same piece. Was that in the Wall Street Journal? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to do a Top of the Pops on that, but I suppose it's probably worthwhile talking through the backstory, even to give it 60 seconds, because a year ago or thereabouts, I explained to our listeners what was happening with SPF. And do you remember this, Mike? I used an Irish farming analogy. I was a bit surprised to see it wasn't picked up for some kind of journalistic prize, because I actually wrote that down beforehand. I was trying to figure it. I had pictures of cows in a field. And anyway, this time I just basically hopped on to Gemini, the new name for Bard, give me a 100-word summary of the story so far. So here's what Gemini is telling us the story is with SBF. It says Sam Bankman-Fried was a crypto wonderkind. His exchange FTX soared in value. He championed crypto regulation and promised a philanthropy focus. But then the market crashed. Questions arose about FTX's solvency. The company collapsed, wiping out billions and leaving investors scrambling. SBF, once hailed as a visionary, faced accusations and investigations. And as you said in your opener there, Mike, and picked up, so he's been thrown 25 years behind bars. What do they say in the UK? Banged up. He's been banged up for 25 years. But millions of customers joined the exchange, and they were kind of drawn to Bankman-Fried's image as this big, shaggy haired kind of, he kind of had a fro of a haircut, and he had this kind of genius thing going on, and probably messy clothes, and as I said, the FTX commercials, they were really, really interesting. They had Tom Brady, the NFL star, had Larry David from Curb Your Enthusiasm. I loved that. It was going through the ages where Larry David was going, I don't think so, where he's looking at the invention of the wheel and the first currency and the coin and all that. So it was a very, very well-known brand over here in Ireland, virtually unknown. And in America and the United States, there's barely anyone who pays attention to media that didn't know about FTX. So it's a comprehensively absorbed brand, and the exchange soared in value, and Bankman-Fried crossed the globe on private jets, and he was at dinner with people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, and like he was hobnobbing with the best of people, or at least the highest echelons in society. Anyway, the whole world came crashing down in November 2022, which is probably in and around the time I did my journalistic masterpiece with the farming analogy. But anyway, I'm not going to hammer that anymore. I'm not going to get an award for that. I'm not going to get an award, but I do ask anyone who has an award to go back and listen to the episode. Anyway, after the crypto website CoinDesk published what it had purported to be a leaked Alameda balance sheet. Was it Alameda or Alameda? Was that the name of the firm?
However you want to pronounce it. So that was the trading firm basically attached to FTX, which Bankman-Fried and Ellison and all the rest kind of ran whatever they wanted to with, basically.
And when CoinDesk went out and told the world that, or leaked this balance sheet, it caused a run on FTX customer funds, and very soon after, the exchange filed for bankruptcy protection because it couldn't deal with the number of people who were saying, here, I'll take my money back, thanks very much. And the Manhattan US Attorney's Office charged Bankman-Fried, better known as SBF, a month later. And as you said in your opener, there has been a kind of top of the pops list of, you know, your top. Back in the 80s, folks, there was a musical show on in the BBC that just everyone watched at my age, and it was called Top of the Pops, and it always did the top 20 musical hits. Well, they did the top 12 white collar convictions. And as you said, Mike, in your opener, Bernie is in number one spot, 150 years. You just can't argue with that. Well, he's gone off to the great big NASDAQ in the sky, and rest his soul. He's on the exchange floor in the sky now, but unfortunately, he is in top place with 150 years, but in joint second place with a paltry 25 years for white collar crime is SBF, our founder and CEO hero of FTX, and then Bernie Ebbers of WorldCom. And I remember WorldCom was the story and a half, and I think, wasn't there a movie about it? I know we were talking last week about BlackBerry, the movie, which I've since watched, by the way, is absolutely brilliant. Watched it last night. But Bernie Ebbers of WorldCom, he got 25 years, so he could send notes to SBF on how it all goes down. And then the CEO of Tyco is a guy called Dennis Kalowski. He got 25 years, or up to 25 years. So 25 years is your, I think it's your standard package if you've been bold at a white collar.
I also don't think SPF is going to serve 25 years. I'd say it would be half.
No. Yes, he'll plea deals, and I'll tell you everything, and I'll tell you where the bodies are in. Exactly. The CEO of Enron, or the president of Enron, Jeffrey Skilling, he got 14 years. And so the list continues down till we hit Elizabeth Holmes, and she's in kind of 10th place. As you said, 11 years, 3 months. And then it goes down to one I remember very well, which was Martha Stewart. And I remember Martha Stewart so well because I was an investor in Martha Stewart on the media at the time. She was she is a very well-known woman in the United States. Again, unheard of here, I would say, or virtually unheard of. She got 5 months for insider trading. Very silly because it was paltry cash that she was dealing with.
Does Nick Leeson make the list?
He doesn't make the list I've got. What did Nick Leeson get? Oh, no. Nick Leeson, by the way, when I founded my Wall Street with John Tyrrell, we started in an incubator space in University College Dublin called Nova. And there was this big cork board with Polaroid pictures of all the entrepreneurs pinned on. And who's right beside me in Tyrrell? Only Nick Leeson.
They're putting the eggheads together, I think, is the problem.
So we'd seen Nick Leeson in there, you know, kicking around with a startup. So he certainly wasn't in prison when I saw him. And I even think he manages Galway United. Are you sure? You're more qualified.
He was like the business director of Galway United for a while, which I thought was funny. All right. So yeah, he's knocking around somewhere.
I don't know if that's is it a badge of honor to say one of the greatest like fiscal mess ups in the history of the world is now our treasurer, like just because he's well known.
Okay, so SBF, it all coming out now where Bitcoin is at near all-time highs. It hit all-time highs a couple of weeks ago. We've got this wave of meme coins happening again, and there definitely seems another air of speculation in financial markets, which crypto definitely takes to another level. Like obviously we have our meme stocks here and DJT is flying, but in crypto, it seems to be times 10, all of that. So I just as someone who's been investing for a lot longer than me, do you think you'll ever find a place in your portfolio for crypto?
Well, yes, I will. In fact, I have. Not too long ago, I was chatting to a friend of mine who has basically made a mini fortune in crypto by investing a small amount in more or less everything. And I think by anyone's standards, he's done very, very well in the game, and he's very technically capable and very, very smart guy, and has been smart in the world of technology from the start. So if he's listening, hello, James, how are you? But James called me and he said there's this one called Block V, and he explained to me what it does, and it kind of made sense to me. But because it was James, I took his advice just as he'll take mine on the stock market. So I don't pretend to be an expert in crypto, it would be a tough sell for anyone if they heard me talk about it. But I have done so. I bought a tiny amount of BlockFi, and the palaver of opening up a wallet for me was enough, because it gets a bit confusing. But I bought BlockFi, and I can't even tell you why. That's there within lies the problem. When I founded my Wall Street, co-founded my Wall Street, John and I were out in Silicon Valley for a few weeks, and we met a friend who's become a good friend of ours, and he said, "Come here, I want to show you something." And he brought us into a server room in San Francisco, which was empty. Like, it was a big room. It was kind of half football pitch size. It was prime real estate, middle of San Francisco. And in the corner, it was just one computer. And he said, "Look at that." And we said, "What?" He goes, "I'm mining Bitcoin." And this was the first time I'd ever heard the expression. It's the first time I ever heard, and probably the last time I actually observed somebody mining Bitcoin. And my friend Derry was over there, and he was mining away. And so yeah, to your question, will I ever invest or consider crypto investments? Yeah, I will. I'll always consider every type of investment. Do I wish to be an expert? No, I don't think I could get there. It's just something that exists. And of course, I lament and regret Bitcoin. It was there for the whole world to see on its run up to whatever it is now, 63 grand or something like that. I think it's had a pullback. I haven't checked.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough as well. I think we have enough time looking at stocks. We don't have time to figure out crypto at the same thing.
Do you have any crypto, Mike?
No, never have. Felt quite foolish at certain points, but I always go back to my friend talking about Askcoin. Who's the bigger fool? You know, me, the person who invested in Askcoin, or Askcoin falling? So that's kind of my take on crypto. I think if you're taking it very seriously, maybe you'll have greater insights than me, but it's not going to be my bag, I don't think. But moving on to more substantial news. Amish, Daniel Kahneman, famous for writing Thinking Fast and Slow, he's an economist, a psychologist. He died at the age of 90 last week. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about one of what you've called history's greatest investing psychologists?
Oh yeah, absolutely, Mike. Well, in the words of Jason Zweig of the Wall Street Journal, Daniel Kahneman explained investors to themselves. And he's probably best known to anyone who knows him, I guess, as the 2002 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science winner. In other words, the Nobel Prize for Economics, along with another guy called Vernon Smith, for their contributions to the field of behavioral economics. And this guy, Kahneman, was pure academic, but he was really brilliant, because a lot of academics at that level, at Nobel level, let's say, lose the crowd, where he certainly didn't. And his work challenged the assumptions of perfect rationality in traditional economic theory, which is the backbone. Anyone who did economics, even in the Leaving Cert, which is the last state exam you do when you're about 17 years old in Ireland, and the equivalent in the US, and those who go through an economic undergraduate, postgraduate, PhD, perfect rationality is always kind of central tenet to the observation of an economic system. But in simple English, he demonstrated how psychological factors influence our choices, which, when you think, is like, that's quite obvious, but it's not obvious until somebody measures it and puts it out there. And I guess the other thing he'd be very famous for is his best-selling book, which is called Thinking Fast and Slow, which was published in 2011. And it explores the concept of System 1, as he calls it, which is fast intuitive thinking, and System 2, which is slow deliberate thinking. And we toggle between these two states in any given day, week, or month. Like, we do quick intuitive thinking, slow considered thinking. And he talks about how these two systems, 1 and 2, influence our decisions. And Zweig, who's a wonderful, wonderful writer, journalist, researcher in his own right, and was the one who made The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham accessible to most, because if you buy that book and just read the footnotes written by Jason Zweig, you'll get through it. But he deserves major credit, because in the beginning, Kahneman wrote the first drafts and chapters, and then Zweig came in and rewrote it and edited it and kind of gave it that accessible vernacular. But nonetheless, it is a tough read. It's a hard, I find it a very difficult book to read. I bought it in Dublin Airport thinking I'll have this done by the time I arrive in JFK or wherever I was going. But it took me months of lifting it and putting it down and giving another shot. So rather than hatchet the tome now with an ill-informed review, I'd suggest to our leaders to buy it or at least look at some of its summaries on X, which has a ton of summaries of the book, and it has some really breakthrough concepts. But I thought, Mike, when I sent you the Slack last night, it would be interesting to give an overview of his life because it is more fitting and it's more interesting. And the man lived to be 90 years old and in his wake clearly left something great. So first and foremost, or perhaps just foremost rather than first, foremost, he was, as I said, a psychologist at Princeton University, and he won the Nobel Prize. And that if you're going to write someone's headstone, or at least include their professional achievements on a headstone, you'd say he was a psychologist at Princeton and winner of Nobel Prize in economics. But before this pioneering work that he did, he and his research, Amos Tversky, who died in 1996, before their work, it was assumed that everybody was just rational, that we're self-interested, we use all available information to make an unbiased decision, our preferences are consistent. Like the definition of a person was somewhat akin to an algorithm or an android or whatever you want to say, but we're emotional creatures. We buy what we believe in, and our beliefs are not necessarily rooted to hard facts. So Kahneman and Tversky showed that that's just nonsense. Like the whole kind of we are utterly rational, that's nonsense. And their findings directly or even indirectly, it inspired change across the business world. And I was really surprised to read this included in America redesigning organ donation programs, improving planning for multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects. Like the impact of what Kahneman did or achieved and wrote and proved is really incredible. So as I mentioned, like he was a pioneer of what became known as behavioral economics, although he always saw himself as just a psychologist. And in the words of Zweig in the Wall Street Journal last week, in the epitaph he wrote, or in the piece he wrote about Kahneman, he said, "Investors who take Kahneman and Tversky's lessons to heart can minimize fees, losses, and regrets. Kahneman may well have had more influence on investing than anyone else who wasn't a professional investor." And then Zweig went on to say in the piece, which I have here in front of me, "I first met Danny, as everyone called him, at a conference on behavioral economics in 1996. For years, as an investing journalist, I had wondered, why are smart people so stupid about money? About 5 minutes into Danny's presentation, I realized he had the answers, not only to that question, but nearly every mystery of financial behavior." And those questions might include things like, why do we sell our winners too soon? Why do we hang on to our losers, for way too long? Why don't we realize that a hot streak is really just good luck? Why do we say that we have a high tolerance for risk and then suffer the torments of, when the market falls down or if a stock we bought falls 50, 80 or 90%? And why do we ignore the odds when we know they're actually stacked against us? And for decades, he and Tversky conducted experiments that were almost childlike in their simplicity to see how people really think and behave. And it was he who ascertained that losses feel, this thing, losses feel twice as painful as the gains feel pleasant. Like that was him. So we kind of throw that around, you hear variations of it, but that was Kahneman. And he asked a conference of attendees that Zweig was at, if you lose $100 and a coin toss and it comes up tails, how much would you have to win on heads before you take the bet? And almost all of the attendees said $200 or more, which was kind of his very simple experiment, which created that 2-to-1 ratio. And there's so many insights thanks to Kahneman. Like, people don't incorporate all available information. We think short streaks in a random process enable us to predict what comes next. We think jackpots happen more often than they do. And if you've been to Vegas, we all know that when somebody, I don't know what the expression is, pulls the lever and there's a payout on a machine, like, it's very visual, it's very audible, it sounds like it's happening every few minutes if you're standing in one of these giant casinos. But when you take the average of what's happening across the whole room, they're not frequent at all. We also think disasters are more common than they are, and that makes us suckers for schemes that purport to protect us from disasters, because we're like, we live in a state of fear. And if we ask people if they want to take a risk with an 80% chance of success, most people say yes. If you ask people, are they ready to participate in a scheme with a 20% chance of failure, they say no. And that's a very simple experiment, which shows we are totally led by this lizard brain. So there's Kahneman, and that's, and I suppose that's an introduction to the man.
It's great. And I think investors of any experience, from someone like you who's invested since the 90s to someone who's starting now, could benefit so much from looking through even just the basic kind of principles of behavioral finance and then the number of fallacies that in all investors go through, irrelevant of their experience, how many times they've gone through it before. It's crazy. And what's interesting is if you've been invested for maybe a year or two, and then you go and study this and you notice those exact processes being described that you've gone through. Price anchoring is a huge one, where you're like, oh, well, the stock used to be 100 and now it's at 80. So it's obviously going to get back to 100 soon. And there's so many more that are very simple top projects when laid out. But the fact that you can actually identify, or unfortunately retrospectively identify them within yourself, just, it makes it so relevant. So it's a definitely great exercise to do for just becoming a better investor in general. It's great to spout all these things about long-term investing and buy and hold and why your timeline is kind of your advantage in the market, but to actually act it out is very different. And realizing what you're up against inside your own head, I suppose, is a great way to start and kind of be able to, because you might have all the right components, but to be able to put them into action is the important part. And not to sell when you're in, I guess, in an emotional state, basically. It's kind of the tenet of everything.
It really is, yeah. And that's the one alpha, as they say, that you can have as an investor is your temperament, to keep it in check. But it's also a dangerous thing to have, because your temperament could be your downfall as well. Anyone can look at a disaster movie or a training video for how to behave in a fire or in an aviation disaster, and the rational you sitting at home would know what to do. But when you're in that moment, it's the irrational you that you're dealing with. It's that fast thinking, part of your brain that you're really up against. And it's a fascinating area. I mean, if I was to rewind and start again, not that I ever wish to, from an academic perspective, it's an area I would love to dive into. I think it's truly amazing stuff.
Yeah. This is awful, but when I was in college, it was one of our behavioral finance. It was one of those modules where like half of the grade was attendance, but it was on like a 9 o'clock on a Friday morning or something. So I used to go and be in the back of the lecture with the Homer Simpson glasses on, falling asleep. So my knowledge of behavioral finance is new, unfortunately, even though I was...
In fairness, it's not fair to get a 20-something-year-old to sit in any room on a Monday morning if they're in college. That's not...
It used to be a lullaby for me instead of actual educational content, unfortunately. Okay, so that was Daniel Kahneman, one of the greats. Before we move on, just a quick reminder from our friends at Vodafone Business. Check out their free 1-to-1 digital support and advice service today to discuss a range of topics from social media tips, cybersecurity, and building a website for your business. Just search Vodafone VHub or click on the link in the show notes. Right, where are we moving on to?
Yeah, so the other thing I want to say, just go in and talk to them, Vodafone. I mean, it's so simple. Just go in. Say Mike sent you. Right, Mike, where are we? What's the story? Okay, so I tell you what, I'm going to let this coffee permeate through my bloodstream while you tell us a little bit about something which I thought was very interesting, and that's MasterCard and Visa have settled a landmark class action lawsuit, which was brought against them by merchants. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so 2 weeks in a row, I get stuck with these class actions and antitrust stuff. And every time I'm like, and by the way, I know very little about antitrust law. But I'm going to say it anyways, I suppose. So basically, the top line is going to read that MasterCard and Visa have settled a $30 billion payout for this class action, basically against the collective of merchants. So while true, this would be quite a misleading headline in a lot of senses. So they're not actually paying them anything out now. That $30 billion is going to come in the next, throughout the course of the next 5 years, where basically both credit card companies are going to lower the swipe fees they charge merchants. So basically, if you go into a shop and you swipe your MasterCard or credit card, debit card, whatever else, the shop has to go and pay them 1 or 2% of that transaction. And it's what's made MasterCard and Visa one of the best, if not two of the best businesses out there.
And it's a duopolistic behavior, isn't it, Mike? Like, basically, they don't go out a step at the other, a bit like Apple and Google on their app stores. They both charge the same amount. And if you go one, you may as well go with it. There's no difference with the other.
Completely. They've just created these all-encompassing payment works that no one can really infiltrate, which we might get into a bit after this. But it's such an enclosed business model that there's no way that these kind of cases don't come against them because they're so dominant. And so while this is, you know, one of the largest antitrust payouts in history, it's not going to cost MasterCard and Visa that much. It's not going to cost them anything up front. So I thought this was really interesting. So the top line says 30 billion quid, but the bottom line says that MasterCard and Visa have agreed to reduce their swipe fees by 0.04 percentage points for a minimum of 3 years, and then after that to hold these fees at below the rates posted at the end of the last year for the next 5 years they're going to be at 0.04%. So basically they're agreeing to a tiny reduction in charges. 0.4% price reduction is what they've agreed to, which equates to 30 billion, which if any kind of shows how strong these businesses are, in a sense. It's just the scale at which they operate. Like,
it's a mistake to look at them and think that they're substitute products. They're not. They both coexist in pretty much every point of sale. If a customer produces a Visa or a MasterCard, you need to accept both. So they're in with everyone. It's not either or, it's both.
Oh, completely. And like, if you think about it, if you're a business owner and you have this, it can be as much as 3%, depending on the credit card, a tax on every transaction that goes through. But probably more important than the 0.04% discount they're handing out is that merchants can now charge extra to customers who use certain credit cards. So this, do you remember last time you're in America, there might've been a sign saying no American Express. Yeah. So basically American Express charges whatever fees, and merchants are able to say, we don't take American Express, or there might be a surcharge. MasterCard and Visa have just put up the blockers against this for years and years and years. And this court case is kind of taking that away. So that is quite a big change. And it'll depend. It won't really make a difference to the day-to-day. But I think if you had a very specific credit card with all these benefits and cashback and airline points or whatever else, that's where a merchant would be like, I have to pay like 3% on this to take it. And I'm going to pass that on to the customer now. So that's where it does come into question. And that's where you might see a bit more of an impact to MasterCard and business. But all in all, I don't really think it will affect them that much. Like, you should always look to the stock price to see how big of an impact this was. So like, you see $30 billion payout and then you see MasterCard and Visa flat on the day. So for that reason, I just, they have this really strong duopoly, and there's very few things I think that will be any significant hits to it. I don't know. That's my opinion, at least for a little while.
It's true. I mean, they've both been magnificent investments. Everybody knows that. I remember years ago when I was researching MasterCard, they were, I, I, I selected them over Visa at that time because they had certainly done a very good job at saying they're a center of excellence for payment innovation. And they had this name as being the great innovators in payment. Now, of course, small upstarts come along, the likes of Venmo and Revolut and the rest, and they have a somewhat disruptive effect. But in reality, as far as I can see, Visa and MasterCard have always done the same thing in the same way. I've seen no great innovation, and that's not a criticism, but they don't need to. They're just juggernauts that are everywhere, and we all have one or the other in our wallet.
Completely, especially internationally. I think there's a new proposed acquisition that might create a kind of noisy neighbor, that's with Capital One and Discovery. So Discovery have the fourth largest card network in the US. I don't think they're international at all. I don't think you go into AIB and get a Discover credit card, could you?
I've never heard of it.
So they're well behind, but in the US, it would be a big enough deal. But the big thing is that there is an incredible amount of regulatory hoops that this acquisition has to go through first. And I'm sure MasterCard and Visa will probably succinctly put a foot on the scale. I think they have enough time dealing with regulators. Even that payout and the concessions to merchants, that's keeping regulators on side, you know what I mean? So it would be $35 billion acquisition of Discovery by Capital One. Combine that with Discovery is the fourth largest card network, and then Capital One is the third largest credit company in terms of purchase volume. So JP Morgan is number one, American Express are number two. And you would create quite a serious operation. It's not at the scale of MasterCard or Visa, as we said, but it's enough to get them thinking. I think the noisy neighbor is a good kind of analogy of what that business could look like. But there is so much antitrust stuff here. Again, antitrust expert on this pod for some reason. But basically, the Biden administration has said that they don't like larger credit companies because it leads to worse results for customers. And that's truly who they care about, especially in an election year. Combine that with smaller banks have proven to give better borrowing rates than larger banks, which Capital One is very much of those larger banks. So it does seem tough that this would go through in the current environment. I'd say if regulators are looking at it and be like, well, we don't like Visa and MasterCard's dominance, surely that would help. Maybe that could be something to put on the scale, but it seems a bit of a rock and a hard place. So it's fairly up in the air. If you take a look at Discovery stock price, it's still trading at a pretty good discount to the acquisition price, which is always a good kind of bellwether for how people see the likelihood of it coming through. The only thing I would say is, though, in the last maybe month or so, it's kind of picked up. So in the month since, so it's about, I think, February 22nd was when the announcement came, and it was trading at a significant, trading at more about 25% discount from the announcement. Since then, there's a small bit of momentum. So maybe investors are seeing something, but yeah, that's kind of state of play at the minute. I would be personally very surprised, taking all my antitrust expertise on the matter, but we'll see. I think, yeah, the DOJ and the overseers have put up a pretty tough stance on these kind of big acquisitions. They definitely don't like them in financial institutions, so.
No, we're seeing more and more of it. Once upon a time, you could acquire what you wanted. And it feels, even in the short history of our podcast, we're talking more about businesses where acquisitions and mergers were blocked as opposed to given the green light, whether it's giant gaming companies or iRobot or whatever it is, you just name it. We're seeing more and more of it. And as the little people out on the street, it's probably for the better.
So it's always with customers at front of mind. That's kind of how it has shifted over the last 20, 30 years.
Right, come here, pitch me a stock, hit me. What have you got? Pitch me a stock, anything at all.
Okay, so the company I'm pitching is AutoTrader. I'd say most people have heard of it. I think their first interaction would likely have been in some form of waiting room, and you pick up a stack of magazines and there's 20 AutoTraders there. But if you're from the UK anyways, the only place to sell your car is, or buy a car, is AutoTrader. It's mad. One of the most profitable businesses in the UK.
So in Ireland, we have Carzone. Is that the equivalent of Carzone?
It doesn't have the same reach at all. So this was the stat I couldn't get over. Sorry, one of the most profitable businesses in the UK. Unbelievable margins, 80% gross margin, 60% operating margins, 45% net margin. For every euro that comes in the door, 45 cents goes into the bank account. But what's amazing about this business, and I couldn't really get over it, was that it's just completely dominant in terms of attention and traffic. So around 75% of total traffic spent on all classified sites to go buy a car or whatever is on Auto Trader. So it put a comparison in its investor deck. And it's like eBay Motors, 35 times traffic of eBay Motors, 25 times the amount of traffic as thing. So that's 70 million visits a month to its website. So the vast majority of the revenue comes from just basically charging sellers to post on the site. It's kind of like charging for car parking spaces, essentially. It's got other services to do with manufacturers and finance companies, but like more than 80% comes from that. So that's the core business. That's all I would have to worry about if I was analyzing this business further. But yeah, just looking at the level of attention from buyers means that there's only one place for sellers to go. And because sellers go there, it's got more options for buyers, and this kind of creates your nice flywheel, and you have your network effects, and that's what everyone likes to see in a good business. So yeah, I wasn't really expecting to see such a kind of defined economic moat when I thought of Auto Trader, but it really, really is there. So yeah, definitely a business worth looking into more. Obviously very cyclical. Auto companies in general will typically move with the economic boom bust cycle, but definitely one I'm impressed with. And just, I couldn't get over the level of profitability there and the level of dominance it has in that market. So yeah, that's Auto Trader.
Great pitch, Mike. Hats off to you. And here's a quick question for you. So has the share price been on a run? Like, is what you've described reflected in the share price? Is it trading at a high multiple? Or do you believe there's a bit of value left? And it's something we should consider looking deeper into.
So you'll see, and talked about it being cyclical, it is very choppy. I think it's up, it might be up about 100% in the last 5 years, which isn't that significant considering some of the performance from other stocks out there. So
does it pay a dividend?
Does, if it's in the UK, I think so, yeah. So yeah, that's Auto Trader. I definitely one worth looking at, especially for UK investors.
Love it, Mike. Well done. Thank you for that.
Now, I'm flipping them back to you. You're going to close out the show with another sneak peek. What do you got for us this week?
Oh, yeah. I forgot. This is our new weekly segment, folks, called Sneak Peek. I think we're going to need a little bit of 70s jingle. Do you remember? Well, you don't remember, Mike, but you've seen 70s TV shows where every little segment had a jingle. And I think we're going to need our own, like, sneakity peek to finish your week. You know, that I've nicked that one. That was from Blankety Blank. But we need a little jingle. Okay, right. So right after this podcast, I'm going to put the finishing touches to the latest buy alert for Horizon, where, as subscribers know, I invest $4,000 of my family's money once a month, and will continue to do so for as long as I have life and $4,000 is to invest. And that's going to be sent to our subscribers this week. But one of the things that I'm going to introduce to Horizon in this buy alert and in my weekly sentiment tracker every week, which goes out every Monday, is the concept of the coffee can portfolio. So I'm going to have the stocks that I own flagged as a coffee can portfolio, ones that I expect to buy and hold, or would buy and hold pretty much at any time, and buy at any time and hold for 12, 15, 20 years. Because those long, long, long holes are the ones that ultimately have benefited me best. And the overused example and overtired example I admit from my own folio is that it was 20 years ago this month where I bought Netflix and fortunately didn't sell it. And it's that kind of mentality on that. There's going to be nine. I'm going to limit the coffee can portfolio to 12 stocks. And there's definitely 9 there at the moment. And that is the sneak peek that's being unveiled in our buy alert on the same day as this podcast is going live. And sign up to Horizon, folks. It's my best effort for the rest of my life.
Before we finish up, just a quick thank you to our friends at Vodafone Business. If you're a business owner in need of a leg up when it comes to your digital transformation, get yourself over to Vodafone VHub and book your appointment today. Emmett, Thanks as always for joining me, and thank you everyone for listening in. That's it for today's show. If you are listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, just scroll up to the top of the page and leave us a quick review. It really does help us out. And that's it. Remember, you can sign up to mywallstreet.com. You'll receive a full dive on one of our favorite deep moat stocks. You can stay up to date on all the latest offers, news, podcast updates, everything you want from us. You'll find it on mywallstreet.com if you just sign up. So if you're not in, you can't win. Thanks for joining us today, and we will talk to you next week.